All right. Thank you very much, Carla, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us on our ISO Net Zero Pathways report results stakeholder session. My name is Kevin Dawson. I'm the Director of Forecasting and Analytics at the ISO, and I'll be joined today in presenting our results by other members of the Forecasting and Analytics team. The Forecasting and Analytics team did the bulk of the work that we're going to present on today, and so they'll be walking you through the details. I'm pleased to be joined by Adam Gaffney, Abbas Badami, Chad Ayers, Lars Renborg, and Leo Tovar today, and all of them will be presenting various segments of the material for you today. Just go to the next slide, Carla. So our agenda for today, I'll give a brief overview of the results and the scope of our net zero pathways work. And then we'll walk through our load forecast, our generation supply results, and our results from the study. And then we'll end up with some next steps. We do have breaks in the schedule for Q&A. As we go through the different sections, if you do have a question, you can put it in the chat, as Carla mentioned, or raise your hand. We will be holding the questions until we have those Q&A breaks throughout the content. We also have a short kind of stretch bio break scheduled for around 11 o'clock this morning. Next slide, please, Carla. So our purpose today is to walk you through the final results and conclusions from our Net Zero Pathways report. We want to give as much opportunity as possible for stakeholders to ask questions about our work and have the opportunity to understand it, and so provide clarification around the work and how we got to the results that we got. And then we also want to discuss next steps, where we go from here after working on this report. Want to thank all who registered for today and are participating in today's session. I think at the last count, we've got 250 plus registrants. So it's great to see the interest, and we know that this is a topic of a lot of interest to many folks. So we're really happy to have you join us here today and participate. And you know, stakeholder input is very important to the ISO across all the work that we do. We want to make sure that the stakeholder experience is relevant, and that our engagement of stakeholders is meaningful for both stakeholders and the ISO. That it's strategic and targeted, that we are inclusive and allow a wide range of views to be expressed and to be heard and considered in the work that we do, and that it does form meaningful input into the ISO's work. We do highly value stakeholder input, and it really helps improve the product that we put together across a number of different areas. So thank you very much for your participation and engagement. Just a quick reminder, you know, as mentioned, we do want to try to get as many questions answered today as we possibly can. So in order to do that, we would just ask everybody to, you know, be respectful in terms of how you ask questions and make points, and that you're allowing sufficient time for others to get their questions forward, and also that everyone sort of keeps an open mind as we go through these materials and the questions. So I'm going to briefly run through the scope of our report and the key conclusions that we reached. And then we'll go into much more detail on a lot of the different sections. So this is really an overview of the work. Just a reminder for those who maybe haven't had a chance to view the report is available on the ISO webpage. These slide materials that we're going to walk through are also available on the webpage. And we also have a data visualization site that contains a lot of the data and charts from the Net Zero report and some additional content as well. So I would encourage everyone to check that out. But these, once again, these slides are available on the ISO website. So why did the ISO do the Net Zero Pathways report, and what are our objectives? And also, I'll touch a little bit on what this report is not intended to be. So the report is intended to be useful information and to provide insights to a wide range of stakeholders about the potential implications of the transformation of Alberta's electricity grid. We know that net zero is quite a hot topic. If you look in the media, just about every day there's some content related to net zero, and in particular the goal of reaching a net zero economy by 2050. And within that goal, there's often a policy objective or an addition around a net zero electricity system by 2035, with the idea that electrification of other parts of the economy with low carbon electricity can help reach the end 2050 goals. So we have looked at 2035 as a target date within our work of what are the potential pathways to a net zero electric system in Alberta by 2035, and what are the implications of those different pathways from a reliability, a market, an emissions profile, and a cost perspective. And so our work is really intended to provide some examination of that and what those implications are. Given that there's still a wide range of uncertainty in this particular area, in terms of how policy will evolve, what the different technologies might be and how they might evolve, how the costs of those technologies might evolve, we've taken a scenario approach to the work to recognize that uncertainty and look at a wide range of potential outcomes. As you'll see, our work does look at multiple scenarios. And we recognize that really this is the start of a conversation rather than the end of it, that there will be additional discussion, additional work around net zero and its implications that comes from our work and other work that's going on. So we really intend this work as from this work, or what this work is not meant to be. So first of all, it's not intended to be a policy recommendation. We're examining potential implications, but this report is not intended to form a policy guidance or a recommendation. It's also not intended to provide expected or required changes to the market design or market rules. This is not a recommendation about any kind of market rule change. We're not providing a price forecast as part of this work. It's not intended to be a price forecast or a market price forecast. And we're not intending this to be a sensitivity analysis or an assessment of the potential market price implications of different carbon pricing policies or, say, emission standards. Next slide, and if anyone is following on the phone or anything, we're on slide 12. So a little bit deeper dive into the scope of the report, what's in it and what's not in it. As mentioned, we look at multiple scenarios in the report from the implications of electrification. We look at a demand forecast based off of the implications of electrification. We'll get into that in more detail later on. But we do have one load forecast that we use for all the scenarios, and some sensitivities around that. Then we have three different supply mix scenarios examined in the report. We'll talk in a bit more detail about those in a minute. from that analysis, we're really looking at kind of three key outputs. We do a resource adequacy assessment, we do an emissions profile, and we do a cost impact assessment. And that cost impact assessment really looks at the generation capital investment required, the operating cost implication of the different supply mixes, and the transmission investment that might be required to realize those different supply mixes. Not to sound like a broken record, but I think it's important to know what the intention is versus what it's not. So not a policy recommendation, not a market design recommendation document. We also have not looked at the detailed delivered cost of electricity in this report. As mentioned, we are not including distribution side impacts, and we're not looking at on a customer rate class by customer rate class the potential implications for delivered cost of electricity. So this is really intended to be a high level examination of the potential cost implications. And finally, there are other aspects of reliability beyond just supply adequacy that are not included in the scope of this report. So things like, will the system have enough ramping requirements? Will it have enough inertia or frequency response or grid stability like voltage support or short circuit capability? That's all beyond the scope of this current report and would need to be followed up in subsequent work. And just a reminder, you know, on that theme of this is really the start of the conversation, the ongoing ISO processes like the long-term outlook or the long-term plan, we do expect those will continue to examine the implications of a net zero future and a transforming electricity grid as we go forward. Next slide, please, Carla. So a really high-level overview of the scenarios that we've looked at, the supply scenarios. Again, we've got a common load forecast between each of these, and the different scenarios are really different mixes of renewable generation, so renewable being wind and solar, energy storage, and abated thermal generation, and the abated thermal generation being natural gas units with carbon capture and storage or hydrogen-fired units. And the scenarios are really different combinations of supply mix based on that. Are on the left, the dispatchable dominant scenario, as the name implies, is the scenario that has the greatest amount of dispatchable abated thermal generation in it. And then as we move to the right through the scenarios, we really increase the volume of renewables in the scenarios and the volume of storage in the scenarios. So our first mover advantage scenario is kind of in the middle. And then the renewables and energy storage rush scenario has the highest amount of renewables and storage and the lowest amount of dispatchable thermal generation. One other thing to note in the scenarios is that our emissions measurement is based on the electric system. And so all of these scenarios also have behind the fence cogen generation in them, and the emissions from that behind the fence cogen, if it's reported for the industries, is treated outside of the electric system. Given the uncertainty of the future and the use of scenarios, we've also developed signposts that will monitor through time and will help us determine, you know, which scenario we're maybe more likely tracking towards or whether completely different scenarios also need to be developed and examined. And really the signposts come down to kind of three main factors. One is around the regulatory and policy side, and how that's evolving and how it may impact different technologies and on both the generation and load side. The technologies themselves, the performance of the technologies and the cost curves. And then finally, the supporting infrastructure that will be required to enable the net zero transformation. So this is things like electric system transmission, pipeline capacity, charging capabilities, those types of things. So those are the signposts that we'll be monitoring on a go forward basis to assess how we're tracking on the scenarios. If we could move to slide 15, thanks, Carla. So I want to run through the kind of five areas of key conclusions from the report. And the first one is the question of, can we achieve these supply mixes by 2035? And I think our answer is that it's possible to reach the supply mixes, but there's significant amount of risk in all of the scenarios that we've looked at. And we've looked at three scenarios out of a number of potential pathways. We think that all of the pathways have a significant risk to hitting the 2035 timeline. We'd really need almost perfect alignment of a number of factors in order to achieve the 2035 date, and there's not a lot of contingency to those factors. And when you think about implementing this change in the supply mix, it requires regulatory policy uncertainty. There's still a fair degree of uncertainty. It will require a timely regulatory decision making. There's a significant amount of new assets that need to come onto the system. And so there's approval and then also construction timeline risk. We're not the only jurisdiction that's looking at making this transformation. Many jurisdictions around the world are looking at making a similar transformation over a similar time period. And so that creates risk for supply chain issues, both on a global basis and even on a local basis when you think of labor and construction crews and materials. There are uncertainties with respect to the technology. So there's still development of these net zero technologies going on in some parts. And in general, there's long timelines for energy infrastructure development. So all of those things need to come together in order to achieve the 2035 timelines. So we see a challenge there. Will a net zero future cost more in the electricity space? And our work indicates that there will be a cost associated with a net zero supply mix relative to a baseline of a non-net zero supply mix. So our baseline that we've used is the 2021 long-term outlook, which is not a net zero case. And we've compared costs relative to that. Again, the cost categories that we've looked at in this report are the capital investment required in new supply, so the incremental generation capital investment required, the operating costs for the supply mix in the resulting scenario, and any additional transmission system investments that are required to integrate that supply mix. So overall, across the scenarios, relative to that non-net zero baseline, we see kind of a cumulative cost impact over the next 20 years of somewhere between 30 to 35%. The bulk of those costs are from generation capital investment and operating costs. Together, those combine about 90% or more of the costs, and the transmission system investment would be certainly below 10%. So the bulk of that investment and that cost will need to come from essentially private investors in our deregulated market structure and putting capital at risk in the market. A reminder of some of the cost categories we've not included, so we haven't included the distribution side. We're also not looking here at the integration costs. So if there are any additional ancillary service costs required to integrate these supply mixes, that would be an additional cost category that we haven't estimated here. And we're also not looking at this as an economy-wide basis. We're looking at a subset of electricity system costs. Any transition to net zero is going to involve some puts and takes across the economy. And so there may be savings in other areas, for example, transportation or heating fuels, where consumers are saving costs that are then being shifted to the electric system. So this is not intended to be an economy-wide assessment of puts and takes. And we'll have more on the cost components later in the slide materials. We could go to slide 17. Thanks, Carla. So will a net zero supply mix be provide sufficient reliability and sufficient supply to the grid? And our modeling indicates that the three scenarios can have sufficient supply, that the Alberta market is capable of delivering sufficient supply to maintain reliability, with a number of risks and caveats to that. Obviously, the timing of entry and exit of generation is critical to maintaining that supply adequacy. In particular, the unabated gas assets, if those retire sooner than expected in our modeling and are not replaced kind of like for like with similar dispatchable generation, that increases supply adequacy risk. In a high renewable case, if there isn't sufficient energy storage, then that also results in an unacceptable amount of supply adequacy risk. On the flip side, if we see increased flexibility on the load in terms of demand response during tight market conditions or tight supply conditions, or demand shifting, demand flexibility from peak to off-peak periods, that can provide significant supply adequacy benefit. And of course, other aspects of reliability around the operational implications of these net zero supply mixes in terms of ramping capability, inertia, frequency response, etc., are not assessed in our analysis and will require further work to evaluate. Go to the next slide. We're on slide 18. So will these supply mixes actually achieve a net zero electricity system? And they will, but offsets will still be required. We see that trying to achieve zero physical emissions in the electric system would be extremely challenging from both an operational and a cost perspective, that as you get try to get closer and closer to physical zero emissions, the operational difficulties increase immensely, and the cost involved with that increases exponentially. And so we do see a continued role for offsets in some form going forward to make the electric system net zero by 2035. You can see that the residual emissions in our scenarios kind of range from just under 4 megatons to just under 5 megatons. And again, we'll have more on these results later on in the slide deck. If we can go to slide 19, Carla. As the final category we looked at is the impact of electrification on demand, and will demand increase, and how much will it increase based on this electrification? So in addition to kind of current categories of load, our load forecast has included electrification impacts on transportation, heating, and industrial load, primarily from increased production of hydrogen in the province. That electrification load is to some degree offset by increased amounts of small distributed resources, primarily rooftop solar. And when we put all of the pieces together, our demand forecast indicates that demand growth over the next 20 years in this net zero transition is expected to be actually lower than the demand growth we've seen in the province over the previous 20 years. And that was a period when we went through significant expansion of the oil sands industry and the related industrial activity. And so we would see, a lot less load growth coming from that going forward, with electrification creating new types of load. But overall, the load growth for the next 20 years looks to be below levels that the market and the system has handled previously. The other large change to demand, given the change in supply and electrification, is the actual load shape on a day-to-day or hour-to-hour basis. And we see that becoming significantly more variable as we go through time and add these different variable sources of supply, as well as different types of load on the system. So that is something that will require additional assessment as to the operational and system impacts of that. We could move to the next slide, Carla, slide 20. So just to close out this section of the agenda, a reminder of the importance of stakeholder feedback in this process and how it's improved the process. So we, throughout development of the net zero pathways, have sought stakeholder feedback at various points in time, and that feedback has helped shape the scope of the report, the assumptions of the report, and really make it overall a better piece of work. So we do thank everyone that has contributed to that, and as we go forward and discuss on this, we certainly intend to continue to engage with stakeholders on this topic and its related impacts. So thank you again for that. So that concludes kind of a brief overview of the scope of the report and the findings. We'll pause at this time to take any questions on that content. And again, we will be getting into detail on all of the areas in terms of load forecast and the specific generation mix results, emissions, reliability, and cost results. I do see some questions in the chat, and then a reminder, if you'd like to ask your question just verbally, please raise your hand.
Perfect. Kevin, maybe we'll start with Mark Baxter. And his written question, and if we can just remind people to put their organization when they're typing in their Q&A, unfortunately, just your first and last name come up, so thank you. So Mark's question, to what extent were costs from inaction on climate change, i.e. costs of increased natural disasters and resulting damage to the grid from a failure to reduce global emissions, included in the modeling?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Mark. So basically, any of those costs were not included in this modeling. Again, we focused on really the electric system costs of the transition, and we're not attempting to do sort of an economy-wide or society-wide cost-benefit analysis. So that would all, the types of costs that you mentioned there would be exogenous to our work.
Thanks. And we will, we've got Benjamin's question. Why do the normalized to load costs of the net zero scenarios increase proportionally more, 40%, than the increase in system costs, 30 to 36%, relative to the BAU slide 16? Given the slide 19 shows the net zero scenarios, have around 6% more load, larger denominator in 2035, than business as usual. I'd expect the normalized increase to be mitigated by the larger load.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Benjamin. And so just to clarify, the 30 to 36% increase that we talk about is measured over the 20-year period from 2022 to 2041. And so what we do notice with the costs, or what we see in the cost profile, is that the costs do increase towards the back end of that period. And the 40% increase from the normalized or dollar per megawatt hour cost number that you quoted is actually measured in 2035. And so you can't really compare that 40% number to the aggregate number across the whole 20-year period. Unfortunately, I don't think we have the numbers anywhere in the report. But if you look at the average over the same 20-year period of the dollar per megawatt hour cost figure, that average actually does show a cost increase of less than the 30 to 35% when you look at that normalized basis. Of course, it does depend on kind of the assumptions you make around the system load there. It's sensitive to that. But you are correct in the sense that as load on the system grows, some of that load growth on a proportional basis on a per unit cost mitigates or tempers the cost growth on that per unit cost. Cost measure.
Perfect. Thanks, Kevin. Kevin, we're just going to go. We've got a couple people with some hands up.
Sure.
We'll start with David Thornton. David, if you can just unmute yourself and then introduce yourself with your organization, please. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think this is a hand that went up by accident. I apologize. Great presentation so far. Thank you.
No worries. Thanks, David. All right. So we're going to go to Surendra. If you just want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Okay, good morning. You guys can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. My name is Surendra Singh, and I'm from Alberta Newsprint, a big load and some generation. Kevin, the slide you had on risk, and then you had the one point on demand response. The demand response can come handy and mitigate some of the risk. And my question is, our current market construct doesn't allow ISO to look for demand response other than what the market participants do themselves for their own cost management. So do you think that to get that kind of benefit, ISO will need some change in market design, so allow them to have some more demand response and with some incentives?
Yeah, thank you, Surendra. I think it's a little too soon to say there exactly how that demand flexibility might be realized. I think our work is pointing to the fact that it's worth additional assessment, additional look into that. Again, we were looking at just what's the sensitivity of the supply adequacy to some of these different drivers. Any kind of discussions about market design impact will have to come after this work you know, there's, it may emerge through time due to technology, et cetera. But it's probably worth an examination of the market incentives and how that demand response might change through time.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. All right, we're going to move back to the written questions. We'll go with Jesse Rowe. Am I reading the electricity cost chart right, that the scenarios estimate an increase in average cost from about 90 megawatts in the LTO and to between 160 megawatts and 200 megawatts for just generation and transmission costs? Distribution costs would be on top of these costs.
Yeah, Carla, do you mind going back a few slides just to the graph that Jesse's referring to? Yeah, a couple more. Yeah, that one.
Okay.
You are reading the chart right, Jesse, in terms of the cost components here are excluding distribution system costs. We have not done any estimates of those costs in here. This is just the components of generation capital investment, basically levelized over time and with a required return on the capital investment built in or assumed. The operating costs of the supply mix and the transmission revenue requirements for the transmission system. So you are correct. I think on this chart, there is a range that we've provided. And again, that range is based off of a pretty high level estimated range of system load. So these are electricity costs divided or normalized by an estimate of system load. So any behind the fence component is not included in that load denominator.
Thanks, Kevin. We've got a question from Darcy before we go to Philip in this hand up. For cogeneration that is owned by a third party, example, infrastructure fund, will the cogen benchmark still remain broken out as a combination of good as best gas and the industrial heat benchmark?
Okay, thanks, Darcy. Maybe I'm going to ask Adam to step in and address that question.
Thanks, Kevin. We did make some assumptions that I'll outline a little further on in the presentation about the high performance benchmarks under the TIER regulation. Specifically to the electricity sector, we've assumed that the high performance benchmark would decline to zero by 2035 in the spirit of net zero by 2035. We felt that would be a reasonable assumption. However, I think it's important to delineate that we don't set the high performance benchmarks, nor do we make recommendations on them. So our assumption is only an assumption that helps us get to net zero by 2035 in the scenarios. Specifically to cogeneration, we didn't make a particular industrial heat benchmark assumption, but we did assume that the entire economy would be under regulation to get to net zero by certain points. So we have assumed that there will be some amount of physical abatement on cogeneration units in Alberta, and that there may be various pathways to that. Some could be carbon capture, some could be co-firing with hydrogen or renewable natural gas, for example. So the assumption that I could make around good as best gas, currently represented as a 0.37 ton per megawatt hour emissions intensity in the electricity sector, we are expecting that that's going to go down in a linear fashion for the purposes of this analysis to zero by 2035.
Wonderful. Thanks, Adam and Kevin. All right, we're going to go to Philip's question, and then we're going to move on to the next section. Philip, if you just need to unmute yourself, and if you could please introduce yourself before you ask your question. Thank you.
Thank you. Philip Duguay, I'm an independent consultant focused on interregional transmission development. This is my first time participating in this ASO process, so I apologize if this was covered earlier. So I do see a reference to interties being scoped out of this process. I was just wondering why, and if there is a potential for further scenarios analysis looking at deeper intertie integration. I mean, there's a lot of economic and technical studies touting the benefits of interties, but also there's just a ton of development activity going on in the U.S. with new FERC regulations. So I'm just curious as to the history of that. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Philip. When we first scoped out this work, and one of our objectives was to look at pathways that could, in our view, achieve a net zero solution or system and be implemented by 2035. And so when we look at interties, we think there's a number of challenges for their development on that time frame. There would be sort of significant, I think, interjurisdictional regulatory discussions that would be required between the provinces to develop significant volumes of increased intertie capacity. There would need to be sort of the agreements worked out both on operating and commercial basis as to how the energy flows would work and the commercial arrangements based on those. And the Alberta market is, a deregulated market sitting in between kind of vertically integrated crown corporations. And then there's just the sort of the physical construction and implementation of the interties. So when we put all those factors together, plus the consideration of, what does the supply picture look like on the other side of the intertie, and how much energy might be there to provide for Alberta in a wide range of situations, we didn't see that as a material way of a viable pathway to achieving net zero by 2035. Certainly going forward, we kind of recognize the other discussions out there around intertie, and would consider significant expansion of intertie capability, as a scenario at some point in the future. But we still think there are those kind of interjurisdictional challenges that could take a while to work out.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
And sorry, Carla, I did notice that Randy had a question about load, and I think we'll probably deal with that in Leo's section coming up. So I think Randy will address your question in just a few minutes here.
Perfect. Thank you. All right, so we will go on, Leo, to your section.
Thank you, Kevin and Carla. Can you give me a thumbs up if you can hear me? Excellent. So for this, we can go to the next slide, please, Carla. Oh, that one, yeah. So for this analysis, the ISO opted for a single load forecast, as Kevin described earlier, and this single load forecast feeds into all three of the net zero supply scenarios. Those familiar with our LTO forecast will find that we maintain a similar methodology to the existing load categories. And by that, I mean the model that includes post-pandemic economic growth, a revised oil sands outlook, as well as gains in energy efficiency. In terms of distributed energy resources, we maintain assumptions pretty much in line with the clean tech scenario described in the 2021 LTO. Solar DR capacity grows to a bit over 2,000 megawatts by 2041, while wind and gas DER's adoption is much more limited and modest during the same time frame. New to this net zero analysis is the expansion of our AIL model, AIL stands for Alberta Internal Load, to include the sectors that are particularly targeted by net zero policies, especially those sectors that have a 2050 target for their net, decarbonization. These economic sectors include transportation, which is where you'll see the rise of electric vehicles, heating systems and buildings, where we assess the switch from natural gas to electric-based heating, as well as growth in industrial loads. We particularly focus in this sector, heavy industries, on the growth of blue hydrogen production in Alberta and the electrical needs that it requires. For these sectors, we assume federal and provincial policy plans are implemented and executed without major constraints or delay. So, for example, we assume that the federal target of 100% of new sales of light-duty vehicles are all battery electric by 2035. We also assume that the government of Alberta's hydrogen roadmap ultimately paves the way for ever more blue hydrogen production in the province. And since blue hydrogen requires natural gas and carbon capture storage, which are very energy intensive, that is going to translate into an increased industrial load. In each of these new electrification models that we've produced, we consulted with experts and benchmarked our results with different reports. We also benefited from the intelligence shared by stakeholders, and particularly DFOs who have done a lot more work in different sectors. So now that you know how our AIL forecast is built, let's dive right into the results. Let's go into slide 24, please. Here, as you can see in both charts, the results go in line with what you would expect, which is there's an acceleration of demand growth due to net zero policies of electrification and decarbonization. Load is expected to grow from around 9,700 megawatts on average in 2021 to 11,200 megawatts in 2035. This is an increase of 15% in 14 years. What's interesting is that load growth is expected to accelerate post-2035 as electrification goes into full swing. By 2041, load is expected to be around 12,200 megawatts, which is a growth of 1,000 megawatts in the last 5 years of our study horizon. In fact, 60% of the 20-year growth is expected to happen in the first 15 years from 2022 to 2035, while the other 40% happens in the last 5 years, which shows how a net zero transition may lead to a rapid pace and back-end load growth post-2035. Of this growth, the biggest drivers, it's electric vehicles. This is going to be followed by hydrogen production as the second largest driver of growth. Building heating is going to be the slowest, according to our modeling. It's going to be the slowest to start and the most modest driver of load in the 2030s, but it rises the fastest post-2035, which shows the potential of building heating to be a more impactful load growth driver into the 2040s and beyond. Of course, let's not forget that AIL could have been much higher had it not been for the offsetting forces of distributed energy resources, especially solar, rooftop solar, as well as, to a lesser extent, energy efficiency gains, all of which are expected to play a significant role in the net zero transition. Compared to a 2021 peak, a future increase of electrification and renewable penetration on the DER side are expected to result in peak AIL growth of 19% by 2035. So as you can see in these two charts that are here, they compare net zero results with the LTO. And in both cases, the net zero forecast is higher than what we projected in the 2021 LTO, which is our current corporate forecast, as well as the one used for the 2022 long-term transmission plan report that was released earlier this year. However, in terms of growth rates, the forecast is still below what we experienced in the booming years of the 2000s and the first half of the 2010s, when we saw a massive expansion of the oil sands and the correlated impact of that on different economic and industrial activities across the province. The net zero forecast grows at an annual rate of 1.1% compared to the 1.9% that we experienced in the past 20 years. This shows that despite the increase in load growth under a net zero transition, the pace of growth is still below what the market has previously accommodated for. We'll jump into slide 25, please. One way to test the individual impact of load drivers is to run a sensitivity case. Sensitivity cases allow us to come up with hypothetical positive or negative deviations from the base inputs to quantify the magnitude and the directionality of each one of the assumptions. In this tornado looking chart that you see in the slide, you will see the list of sensitivities that we produced and how they measure against the measured load expected for 2035, which is 11,200 megawatts, like I said before. Given that policy and technology adoption are the biggest uncertainty, the sensitivities that we produce touch on these exact assumptions. We specifically looked at oil sands production, whether there's an acceleration or decline in them, adoption of electric vehicles, adoption of carbon capture storage technology, especially in the cogeneration sector, energy efficiency gains, changes to temperature, as well as heat pump adoption as a way of replacing a natural gas-based heating in buildings. Notably, oil sands production and electric vehicle adoption are the most impactful drivers of load growth. This underscores the importance of tracking developments in these two sectors, the oil sands and the electric vehicle sectors. Whether it's policy initiatives and incentives, whether it's geopolitics and energy security policies, or global supply chain issues, we will be monitoring these sectors as part of our signposts to guide our future work related to the evolution of net zero. We'll go into the next slide, please. In addition to load growth, we're going to see a different type of load. And by that, I mean that the forecasted hourly shape of load is going to be slightly different. Or actually, let me modify it. It's going to be vastly different. It's not just going to be different from the traditional load shape that we've seen in Alberta up to now, but it's also going to be different from what we have in our LTO forecast, which is our current forecast of reference, the difference of which you can observe in this chart that we have here. And in the report, we have a more expanded version of this chart. This chart compares the net zero forecast in the top and the reference case in the bottom. And at a quick glance, you will notice how the net zero chart is more variable and distinct than what we have in our current LTO forecast. The main drivers of this variability are solar DER variability as well as electric vehicle charging profiles. These two technologies will come in with unique seasonal and intraday variability, and this is why we're going to be studying them further as part of our system flexibility assessments. And in case you're not aware, the ISO just released the System Flexibility Assessment Report that looks at the 2021 LTO, and we'll be talking more about how we're going to take these net zero scenarios and study them under our system flexibility templates and of analysis. We'll go into the last slide of related to load. Thank you, Carla. So we're on slide 27 now, and our analysis also looked at the impact of net zero transition to demand transmission service, or DTS load. And if you're not aware, DTS load is when you subtract behind the fence load from Alberta internal load, AIL. And essentially, it's the main load definition that pays for all the transmission asset investments. Our analysis shows that a net zero transition may impact DTS load growth in multiple ways that we can't foresee at the moment. When you look at an increased sectoral electrification, higher industrial load, as well as greater DERs, you quickly realize that these trends don't all have the same directional impact to DTS and system load. For example, electric vehicles and buildings, they will probably impact DTS growth rates, as they're probably going to be done using electricity from the grid. But when it comes to hydrogen load and other industrial sources of load, especially if they come with self-supply and you couple that with DERs, they will decrease DTS growth rates. So for this reason, we adopted a range-based approach to estimated DTS load into the future, which is what you see in this chart. The range was informed by the historical DTS to AIL ratio and its recent downward trend that we have seen. The range, it goes from 65% to 75% of AIL. We also have a 70% estimate, which aligns with the current ratio of DTS and AIL. Admittedly, this is a simplified methodology that is top-down and highly depends on AIL growth and directionality, but it still provides us good directional and reasonable ranges that can be used for subsequent analysis, including the cost-to-ratepayer analysis that we have talked about in the beginning and that we'll dive a little bit more in subsequent slides. I'll pass it on to my colleague, Adam Gaffney, to talk about regulatory assumptions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leo. I'll move on to slide 29, please, Carla, where we'll just briefly outline some of the key regulatory assumptions that we made to support the net zero analysis. So we assumed that the carbon price and the regulation will follow the tier regulation that we have in place currently, but that there will be some modifications to the carbon price, increasing by $15 per ton from $50 a ton in 2022 up to $170 per ton by 2030, as announced by the federal government. And thereafter, we've applied an inflationary escalator, expecting prices to follow consumer price indices. We've also made an assumption about the tier high performance benchmarks for electricity and hydrogen, and specifically that those would decline. So in the case of electricity, we've assumed that the benchmark will decline linearly from the 0.37 ton per megawatt hour level today to zero by 2035. And in the case of hydrogen, we've assumed that the benchmark will decline linearly from 9.068 tons per ton of hydrogen produced to zero by 2050. So effectively, emissions performance credits generated by the electricity sector are expected to decline in value until 2035, at which point they would no longer generate value. Stepping on to slide 30, I'll outline some of the fuel cost assumptions as well, looking at the comparative costs of natural gas, blue hydrogen, and green hydrogen. We reviewed several sources of combustion fuel, and we wanted to get an understanding of what the cost of these various fuels would look like. So blue hydrogen, since it's produced from natural gas, was estimated using steam methane reformation, as well as the sequestration of CO2 produced by way of the process. And the ASO included the levelized cost of capital and the operating costs associated with the SMR. We also included the feedstock for blue hydrogen, which is natural gas, and the sequestration costs as part of the blue hydrogen cost estimates. When we looked at the cost of green hydrogen produced via electrolysis of water using green electricity sources, we estimated that based on the levelized capital cost associated with electrolyzers and estimated the cost of electricity produced from green sources. So presently, our calculations indicate that blue hydrogen is lower cost than green hydrogen, and our net zero analysis relied on blue hydrogen as a result for the hydrogen sources in our analysis. Stepping on to slide 31, we'll see how the cost of natural gas inclusive of carbon and the cost of hydrogen change in our analysis over time. So carbon prices are expected to increase the variable cost of natural gas-fired generators, and combined cycle costs are expected to increase significantly as the carbon price increases and also as the high performance benchmark for electricity declines. The blue hydrogen fuel costs incorporated the cost of natural gas feedstock, the capital and operating costs associated with steam methane reformation, and then we subtracted from that the value of offsets that could be derived via sequestration. And so offset value increases over the forecast period since the carbon price increases more quickly than the high performance benchmark for hydrogen declines. The cost of residual emissions from blue hydrogen also increases, resulting in an increase in the net fuel cost for blue hydrogen subsequent to 2030. So given the assumptions that we've made, blue hydrogen becomes a more economic fuel source than natural gas by 2027 in the net zero analysis. Next, we'll step into some of the scenario details regarding generation. And on slide 33, I'll briefly outline the three scenarios that we looked at. There are many potential pathways that could lead Alberta's electricity sector to net zero emissions, and we selected three for a more detailed level of study. Each of the scenarios incorporates the same net zero load forecast that Leo had described previously, but it incorporates different levels of wind, solar, generation and energy storage, as well as abated thermal assets to achieve net zero emissions by 2035. So specifically, the three scenarios are the dispatchable dominant scenario, which is focused on dispatchable low emissions technologies with carbon capture as major contributors to capacity. To dominate the supply additions. Our next scenario is the first mover advantage scenario, which is a scenario with rapidly decreasing costs for wind and solar generation that lead to increased renewable penetration accelerated through the 2020s. Hydrogen simple cycle generation also fills some of the voids left by intermittent renewable generation. And the scenario continues to incorporate the development of assets backed by renewable power purchasing arrangements from corporations as mechanisms to achieve sustainability objectives. Our third scenario is the renewable and storage rush scenario, which incorporates significant levels of wind and solar generation continuing through the forecast horizon and dominating generation additions in the province. And there's also significant storage cost declines enabling a diverse suite of energy storage technologies in this scenario to help meet some of the dispatchability and balancing requirements of the grid. Thermal generation assets are limited in the scenario to hydrogen peaking units. Stepping on to the next slide, 34, we understand there are many alternative pathways and we've only looked at three. So specifically, we did not look at hydroelectric as an option by 2035. Similarly, we didn't look at nuclear as an option by 2035. And we also did not explore interties with other low carbon jurisdictions, as Kevin had mentioned earlier. These net zero solutions would require significant development timelines, and the regulatory process could extend into timelines that would be unachievable by 2035. We expect that high capital costs, long construction timelines, and complex interactions between regulated and competitive market structures would make these technological solutions more challenging given the current framework in Alberta. Next, I will turn over the presentation to Lars Renberg, who will walk us through the total capacity additions in each of the scenarios and also some of the scenario details.
Thank you, Adam. Yeah, here we have a summary of the generation capacity for greater than 5 megawatt assets on the top part of the table. We also show the total capacity of assets that are less than 5 megawatts below by technology, and the bottom has the load statistics for each of the three net zero scenarios. We've also included information on the previous 2021 LTO scenarios. So some key trends we see from the table. We have in dispatchable dominant an increase in the thermal generation. We see that the hydrogen simple cycle and combined cycle with CCUS are capacities are the highest out of all three scenarios. When we move into the first mover advantage scenario, you can see the wind and solar total capacities increasing as shown in 2035, and we have also a decrease relative to the dispatchable dominant in the thermal generation as increased competition from renewables lowers the amount of hydrogen simple cycle and combined cycle with CCUS that we see in the scenario. For renewable storage and rush, renewables and storage rush scenario, we see further increases in renewables, and we also see higher penetration of storage technologies, particularly in the shorter duration battery storage technology. This scenario has the lowest thermal technologies developed with no combined cycle with CCS developed and less hydrogen simple cycle developed. On the DIR side, on the less than 5 megawatt generation side, which are generally distribution connected, we have very similar forecast to the 2021 LTO clean tech scenario, with the solar technology being the dominant technology in that space. And on the load side, we have a snapshot of the peak and average load for the net zero scenarios as compared to both the 2021 LTO clean tech scenario and the 2021 LTO reference case. And we see specifically in the year 2035, that the load both on a peak and average basis is higher in the net zero scenarios. And we can move to the next slide. That'll be slide 36. So here we have a summary of the renewable penetration with two different perspectives. So on the left side of the table, we have the percentage of total domestic generation provided by renewables for different years for the different scenarios. And then on the right table, we show this from the perspective of using the system load forecast as the denominator. And we can see the renewables increasing in all the scenarios up until 2035. And then in post-2035, we see the renewables and storage rush scenario continuing to see renewable increases with the dispatchable dominant and first mover advantage scenarios tapering off with renewable additions in those later years. Also to note, both the first mover advantage scenario and the renewable and storage rush scenario meet 30% of total domestic generation being served by renewables by the 2030 timeline. And we see the highest renewable penetration in the renewables and storage rush scenario, and with 47% reaching 47% of total generation in the province being provided by renewables. And then from the system load perspective, with the lower denominator, we have a higher, even higher penetration at 68% by 2041. And we can move to the next slide. And we have a summary here of the assumptions and signposts for our dispatchable dominance scenario. So as mentioned, the main technologies that expand in this scenario are the combined cycle with CCS and hydrogen-fired peaking units. Also, the scenario assumes that the necessary infrastructure required to support the combined cycle with CCUS and hydrogen electricity assets would be in place in a timely manner. So these would include storage hubs and transport for carbon dioxide, or also hydrogen pipelines. And this infrastructure is also a key signpost for the ISO, as infrastructure would need to be in place in order to facilitate the electricity generation development. So it is something that the ISO will continue to monitor going forward. Next, we have here on slide 38, we have a summary of the additions and the retirements on an annual basis by technology for the dispatchable dominance scenario. And we see a lot of renewable additions in the start of the forecast. These are projects that have met the ISO's project inclusion criteria. We also have some thermal developments in the near term, which are also in that category. Our first combined cycle with CCUS development happens in 2026. And this is taking advantage of coal to gas retirements that are occurring and combined cycle retirements that are occurring, and also takes the opportunity to enter prior to the hydrogen-fired simple cycle assets. The hydrogen-fired simple cycle assets start entering in the 2030s once the infrastructure required to support them is in place. And we have a second tranche of combined cycle with CCUS building in the late 2030s, responding to increasing load growth and further retirements of existing natural gas-fired generation retirements. For the storage forecast for this scenario, we've assumed 300 megawatts. Oh, yeah, not quite there. So for the storage forecast, we're assuming 300 megawatts of lithium-ion batteries are added over the forecast horizon in the 2020s and the 2030s. And the assumption is that these would predominantly be participating in the ancillary services market. And that concludes that slide. Let's move to the next. And so for the first mover advantage scenario, this one, we have a higher renewable development in the scenario, so that contrasts it to the dispatchable dominant scenario. And these would be driven by both corporate PPAs and assumed cost declines for the wind and solar technologies. We have wind and solar developing in the 2030s, and then wind and solar developing in the 2020s, and wind continuing to develop in the 2030s. And we do see the wind development tapering off at the end of the 2030s as a result of an assumed decrease in the emissions performance credit and offsets values. For the thermal side, we do scenario, although as mentioned before, it is less than what we have in the dispatchable dominant scenario. And also, we assume that the required infrastructure required to support those technologies would be in place in a timely manner. Next up here, we have a summary of the additions, annual additions and annual retirements for the first mover advantage scenario. Excuse me. We have the same renewable development in the near term, so the same projects that met the ISO's project inclusion criteria. And we start to see, we see solar the solar discount that solar starts to experience in the forecast. So with the highly correlated nature of the the premium that it gets on pool prices is declines, and that provides downward pressure on solar development. For wind, we see that continuing into the 2030s, and as mentioned before, it tapers off mid 2030s. We have combined cycle with CCUS entering in 2026, same as the dispatchable dominant scenario, although not as much is developed. And we see the hydrogen entering in the 2030s. So this is taking advantage of lower renewable hours and also undercutting the existing natural gas fired generation due to the increasing carbon price. For the storage forecast, we have the same storage forecast that we assumed Horizon, again, expected to predominantly participate in the ancillary services market. My colleague Chad Ayers, and he will be
So renewables and storage rush scenario. This is really a scenario where energy storage technologies gain prevalence in the market and where new dispatchable thermal generation has limited development. This future could occur for a variety of reasons. It has three main signposts. There could be stronger development of renewables from increased environmental, social, and governance. Benefit of shorter development timelines. Energy storage could see development from reductions in government initiatives. And on the thermal side, thermal generation development could be limited due to higher than expected costs, low operational performance, or regulatory restrictions. Given these three signposts, this scenario reaches energy storage and relatively low thermal generation. Next slide. On slide 42, talking about the capacity additions and retirements. In the near term, additions in this scenario contain large amounts of wind, solar, cogeneration, combined cycle. These are projects, as Lars mentioned, that meet the inclusion criteria. After that, in the late 2020s, wind and solar continued to develop, and we began to have large amounts of short-term energy. Generation. This new generation is supporting increased demand. 4,100 megawatts of energy storage. Just talking about the energy storage operation, the short-term energy storage is key. Demand, moving renewable energy from periods of low net demand to periods of high net demand. It has a large amount of renewables. And that'll move us to the next slide. So, next slide is an open Q&A. Carla, do you want to moderate the Q&A?
Yes, thanks, Chad. Sorry, I was just having some trouble finding my start video. My apologies. So at the moment, we don't have any hands up, but we've got lots of questions in the Q&A. So we're going to start with Nancy's. With your AIL hourly shape on slide 26, do you think that implies a lower or even negative power prices during the midday because of the solar DIR? Have you guys looked into what's the impact on the solar realized prices and on the must-run baseload generation, such as more startups during the year?
Great. Thanks, Carla. And you cut out a bit. So just to repeat the question, it's a question from Nancy and a written one about the side, but more so on the greater than 5 megawatt technologies. So to answer your question, yes. But for those assets that are able to cycle, we certainly see more cycling as a result of higher renewable penetration.
Perfect. Sorry, I just had some connection issues. My apologies. So we're just going to go with Benjamin's question. Supporting Leonard's question, what are the natural gas fuel input costs that you used across the operating cost analysis of all scenarios? Page 31 indicates $1.92 gigajoule as an input for your blue hydrogen production cost analysis. And that this seems to be an approximately consistent with figures 13 at $15 megawatt fuel cost for NGCC at approximately 7.5 heat rate. This matches up. Did you use around $1.92 gigajoule for natural gas fuel input costs for all years of the operating cost analysis across all scenarios?
Happy to take that question. So we'd point you to, we do have a Power BI dashboard published on the website, and on slide 12 of that dashboard, there is a graph there of the assumed natural gas cost per gigajoule for both the net zero scenarios and also what was used for the 2021 LTO. So for the net zero, the gas price ranges from to a little over $4 a GJ out to 2041. And those are nominal dollars.
All right. Next, we're going to go to John's question. Genesee 1 and 2 are being repowered into CCGT units, which will add 538 megawatts of net capacity in quarter 4, 23, H1, 24. That additional capacity doesn't seem to be included in the capacity additions graphs for any of the three scenarios. Might be captured in some of the CCGT, CCUS for dispatchable and first mover in later years. Furthermore, Genesee 1 and 2 are currently stand 800 megawatts seem to be included in the steam boiler retirements for 2028. Can you clarify how in this progress repowering is included in your modeling, specifically whether one Genesee 1 and 2 repowering for 2024 to CCGT is factored into your modeling for all three scenarios, and two, whether that 538 megawatt CCGT capacity addition around H124 is included in your modeling?
Yeah, I have to take that question as well. So for the Genesee 1 and 2 repowering projects, our process for the forecast, and this would be the case for the LTOs we release as well, is that we include projects based on the ISO's project conclusion criteria. So in the development of the forecast, that project had not met the inclusion criteria, so it was not specifically included in the forecast. However, we do have a combined cycle with CCUS generic additions for both the first mover advantage scenario and for the dispatchable dominance scenario, which could represent a project like Genesee 1 and 2. And specifically for the renewable rush scenario, we did not assume any generic combined cycle additions other than the ones that have, again, that had met the project inclusion criteria. So for that scenario, Genesee 1 and 2 would not be considered in that scenario.
Perfect. Thanks, Lars. We've got another question from Leonard. Can you expand on what capacities were set by assumptions and which were added by the model?
Yeah, I can take that question as well. We took we started as a base of using the market simulation tool that we have, and so that looks at the economics of different technologies and chooses those that are most profitable. So for the dispatchable dominant scenario, we had limited additions that we manually placed in to the model, and then for the first mover scenario, what we did was we determined the renewable build outside the model, and then we allowed the market simulation tool to build thermal generation additions around that. And so that renewable additions there was based on looking at the economics of different technologies, wind and solar, and we determined that outside of the model. And then for the renewable and storage rush scenario, our approach was to use the market simulation tool, but to restrict the amount of thermal generation that could develop in the scenario. So in response to that, the model, instead of adding thermal generation, which it does in the other two scenarios, it adds storage and renewables in place of that. So that's at a high level how we got to the diversity that we see in the three scenarios.
Lars. We've got one from Gloria, and just wanted to acknowledge that some of the answers to questions are being typed in, and you'll find those in the tab that says answered. So on Gloria's question, is ISO making public the information of capital and operating costs utilized for the analysis? Is there a way in which we can access those costs, including blue hydrogen fuel costs?
Yeah, so for the cost data, in the write-up, we do have some summaries. For example, for the cost of hydrogen, that is, we've provided some tables that summarize that. We also have cost data related to the generation capital costs and operating costs and variable costs by technology summarized in both the the write-up and the dashboard that we have. As far as the cost on the aggregated side, we have chosen to aggregate up the costs for operating costs, for example, and emissions into that operating section. And so that's just to provide a high-level view of where the overall costs are going. But for more detail, I point you to the report and predominantly the report on assumptions that were made on costs.
Wonderful. Thanks, Lars. All right. Still doesn't look like I've got any hands up, so we'll go on to Grace. For the dispatchable dominant scenario, in net zero assumptions, did you include the incremental emissions resulting from increased fossil fuel extraction that would be required for NGCC hydrogen, other power generation originating from fossil fuels? And this is Grace from Emissions Reduction Alberta. Thank you.
I can take that question. Thanks for the question, Grace. We looked at the natural gas emissions intensity for natural gas fired emissions. So we didn't necessarily include each and every upstream piece of that may be incorporated. But for hydrogen, we did include the emissions that would be produced from either SMR or ATR hydrogen production. That would be the fugitive emissions or the remaining emissions that couldn't be captured. And we've estimated those to be about 10% of total emissions from that process. So we did include the carbon costs associated with those emissions. In terms of other power generation, we had assumed for renewable power generation zero emissions for wind and solar, although there may be very modest amounts associated with those technologies. And for combined cycle with carbon capture, we also assumed a 90% carbon capture rate, so 10% of the emissions released.
Thanks, Adam. It looks like we've got a hand up over here. So we've got Jawinder. If you want to, I've allowed you to talk. You just have to unmute yourself on your side, and if you could introduce yourself. Thank you.
This is Gurvinder, and this question is for Leo. When you say significant solar penetration, what ranges are you considering? Currently, AESO do not have the visibility of any capacity less than 5 megawatts. So will in future AESO will have the visibility of less than 5 megawatt? And if not, how did you come up with 2000 plus megawatt figures?
Thank you for that question, Gurvinder. That's a really good question. The assumption that we made, I'll answer the last part of that question first. The assumption that we made is we looked at the economics of rooftop solar, as well as the potential availability or places that could be placed on different buildings across the province. And we came up with an estimate around 2,000, a little bit north of that, by 2041, depending on, you know, the economics and tech and the availability of space. You know, we've seen a big growth in this part of microgens and DCGs in the last year and a half. We've been monitoring this thanks to some of the data that we do receive from, you know, different sources, working with DFOs as well as, you know, with the commission. And a lot of this, it's based on, you know, it's a simulation. So we're assuming a net zero transition. We're going to see a lot more consumer switching over to decentralized sources of energy. And as a result, we're going to get to that assumption. Whether it comes through or not, I guess we'll see in 20 years from now. Going back to your question about how do we have any visibility of them, and you're right, we don't. When an asset, it's 5 megawatts or larger, they are required to have a lot of telemetry infrastructure that would allow us to read their generation on a real-time basis, and it will give us a better guidance. But when they're below 5 megawatts, it becomes more of an option, especially for microgens, you know, under 150 kilowatt. That becomes very prohibitively expensive for them to install the type of telemetry that will make us see their generation on a real-time basis. As a result, what we've resorted to doing is, and this is something that is aligned with other ISOs as well, is we're estimating their generation based on meteorological data as well as some stall capacity data, which we do have visibility of, and we get that information on a monthly basis. So we make our best guess assumption based on that, and then that's what we'd use for our inputs of our models. And lastly, I want to touch on the role of DFOs in this. We're going to be talking more about how we're going to engage DFOs, but you know, the increase of DER penetration is something that the ISO has been looking at very seriously for the past few years. We were part of the commission inquiry on this, as well as we have put together a DER roadmap where we have listed a series of actions that we're taking on in terms of increasing the visibility, as well as making sure that integration of DERs is done in a way that is reliably safe to the system.
Thanks for answering.
Leo, I just wanted to jump in and do a quick plug there too, because we also on a monthly basis produce a micro and distributed generation capacity report. So, Gurvinder, you can find that on our webpage, and you can see, you know, by technology type, the installed capacity. So we don't have real-time operational visibility of those sub-5 megawatt units, but we do have visibility of how much of it is being added to the system, and so we keep track of that.
Good point, Kevin. And just quickly Google ISO microgen report, and it will pop up for you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, and so it looks like we'll go to Roslyn's question. Did ISO's analysis consider if the volumes of hydrogen required for hydrogen simple cycle power generation could be available and by when? Does this assume any hydrogen infrastructure build out / volumes all go to power generation?
Yeah, I can answer that one. So we have looked at the amount of hydrogen required to fuel the electricity generation that we have forecasted in the scenarios. And off the top of my head, I think it's around 20 to 30% of the hydrogen production that we forecast on the load side for the whole province is being used in the electricity sector, subject to check. And so basically our approach was on the load side, we have forecasted some hydrogen to be exported or used in other sectors, and some portion of it to be used as an input to the electricity sector.
Wonderful. Thanks, Lars. We'll take Jessica's next. Why was the decision made to not include small modular reactors as an option for the model to build approaching the mid-2030s? I believe, Chad, you're taking that one.
Yeah, I can take that one. So these are technologies that haven't been deployed in Alberta, and we'd expect them to have significant regulatory and construction timelines to make commercialization. As such, they might struggle to achieve the objectives by the 2035 timeframe. And so really, given those development timelines, this is the technology that we didn't have within the scenarios.
Okay. Thanks, Chad. And it looks for Michael. Leo is typing in an answer there. And it doesn't. Oh, all right. So we have another question from Michael. Michael's second question for light duty vehicles and medium duty vehicles, electric vehicle growth, in the net zero emissions pathways, how close does it line up with the federal emissions reduction plan new sales target goals?
I can take on both Michael's question. I was going to type in. For the first one regarding crypto mining load in the province, Michael, I'm not sure I understand your question directly in terms of net zero emissions. When I looked at any of the, you know, decarbonization plans that the federal government has, you know, laid out in its ERP or emissions reduction plan, it doesn't really touch on crypto mining loads or any crypto mining operations per se. However, you know, when it comes to any of those projects, they're pretty much driven by their unique economics, including the volatility of their output product prices. And so from that perspective, I will have, you know, you will have to potentially ask that question to crypto mining developers directly to better understand whether they're seeing that. But from our modeling perspective, crypto mining is not a separate sector that we have modeled separately. Like I mentioned at the beginning, we only looked at transportation, industrial load, as well as buildings, in addition to our other existing load categories that we have traditionally looked at in the LTO. Happy to chat more if you have more specific questions about that. In terms of your question about light-duty vehicle and medium-duty vehicle growth, yes, it does line up with the federal emissions reductions plan and specifically the sales targets that it has laid out for 2026, 2030, as well as 2035. I would just caution that the federal government has been very specific for light-duty vehicles, but when it comes to medium-duty vehicles, heavy-duty vehicles, and including buses, they're not so specific into those three last categories, particularly because there are other potential zero-emissions-based vehicle options out there, including hydrogen fuel cells, that could potentially, you know, play it out eventually. So we have made some modest assumptions. You can see all those assumptions directly in our electric vehicle section of the report. And if you have more questions about that, happy to address them. Thank you.
Thanks, Leo. Looks like Nancy Adam is typing an answer for you, Nancy. We might, since we're done the questions, we don't have any hands up, we just might take our break a touch early here. So it is, Kelly, you're coming in for another question. Solar Utility Incorporated, thank you, Kelly. Other market operators such as AEMO in Australia are forecasting solar and storage capacities relative to market AILs, which are significantly higher, over 10 times ISO's forecast by 2035, primarily due to DER aggregators, thousands of DERs operating as a virtual power plant, who are encouraging solar adoption by offering financial incentives to retail energy consumers. Do your forecasts include any assumptions on rapid acceleration of DER aggregation, VPPs, in Alberta?
I can take that question if you'd like, Carla. We did not make any specific assumptions about rapid acceleration of DER aggregation. We did make assumptions specifically around solar growth. And so our growth forecast for distributed energy resources that are specific to solar incorporated over 2,000 megawatts by 2041. Now, clearly, there are differences between Alberta's electricity market and our microgeneration regulation here and markets elsewhere in the world, such as Australia, and certainly differences in the resources as well. So our estimates for the 2,000 megawatts or just over 2,000 megawatts of supply from solar DERs were related to economic models that we've built.
Perfect. Thanks, Adam. All right. So we're gonna take a 10-minute break now. It's 10:42, so we're gonna come back about 10:50, so 10:52 around there. And so we will see you in 10 minutes. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Before we kick back into the presentation, Adam's just got a couple of clarifications he was going to make before we start in with emissions outcomes. Adam?
I think the clarification, I might just hop back to slide 31 briefly just to look at the hydrogen fuel costs and understand what's leading to first the decline and then the increase in hydrogen fuel costs. We've netted off the emissions offsets from these costs. And so the emissions offset value is changing over time. It's increasing over time. But the high performance benchmark is decreasing over time. And so that leads to a situation where first the hydrogen fuel costs are declining because the offsets are worth more than the compliance costs for the remaining emissions. And then subsequent to 2030, the cost starts to increase beyond that point.
Wonderful. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks.
All right. Lars, you are up next, and I'll just move forward to your slides. On emissions outcomes. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Carla. Welcome back, everyone. And so here next slide here, we are summarizing the emissions outcomes for the year 2035 for the different net zero scenarios. And we also compare it to the 2021 LTO reference case. So for context, we're today in the electricity sector, we're sitting at approximately 30 megatons annually. And so in the 2021 LTO here, we see forecast emissions to decline to 17.7 megatons. And then the net zero scenarios forecast a further decline such that we reach between 3 to 5 megatons on an annual basis for emissions for that year. And in order to reach the net zero target, it is assumed that since we have these remaining physical emissions in the electricity sector, Alberta would need to use something like, we would need to use could use emissions performance credits or offsets to mitigate those remaining emissions. Also, what we find is as you reach the physical zero level in emissions, the costs associated with getting to that level increase exponentially as it gets more and more difficult to physically abate those emissions. And as Kevin talked about a bit at the beginning, there's also operational considerations of reaching that zero emissions target, as there would be assets like natural gas fired assets that couldn't run under that setup. Here we summarize the dispatchable dominance scenario. So we have the emissions outcomes specifically for that scenario for the summarized with different technologies. So we see the historic emissions on the left, and then we see the forecasted emission decreases. And so as coal to gas retires, we can see that causes significant emissions reductions. And then by the time we get out to 2035, we have mostly existing natural gas combined cycle producing emissions, but we also have some fugitive emissions from the combined cycle with CCUS and also some fugitive emissions from the hydrogen production process for the fuel that is used for hydrogen units, and also some from cogeneration and coal to gas. And another thing, the important thing to keep in mind with these numbers is that something that was also mentioned briefly at the beginning, for the cogeneration emissions, we have excluded a large part of the cogeneration emissions as a part of these numbers. And the philosophy behind that was that for the emissions reporting, the way the Government of Canada reports the historic emissions, a lot of the cogeneration emissions are actually allocated to these respective industries that those cogeneration serve. So examples could be oil and gas or forestry. And so for the purposes of showing the forecast, we stuck to just showing the emissions that are reported under the electricity sector in order to facilitate an easier time to compare to historics. Also to note, so once you get down to that 4.8 megaton level for the dispatchable dominant scenario. There's the option of using offsets or emissions performance credits to mitigate that those emissions. And there's also the possibility of retrofitting these existing natural gas-fired assets with carbon capture or replacing them with lower carbon technologies. And we haven't shown the other two net zero scenarios here, but they follow the same trajectory and they have a similar breakdown and for the different technologies. And if you go to the dashboard of the report, you can see all the detail of where the emissions are coming from by technology. And that summarizes the emissions. So I'd like to pass on to my colleague Abbas to cover the resource adequacy section.
Thank you, Lars. In this section, we'll cover the resource adequacy and the reliability aspects. Moving to slide 49, as a part of the net zero analysis, the AESO evaluated the risk of unserved energy and resource adequacy for all the three scenarios mentioned previously for the year 2030 and 2035. The load and generation specifications for resource adequacy model were aligned with those mentioned under each net zero scenarios as base case scenarios. Additional sensitivities, as will be presented shortly, have also been evaluated for each of the three scenarios. The RAM tool, which is the same one which was used during the capacity market simulation, simulates thousands of iterations to identify the frequency and magnitude of firm load shed events and determine if the long-term adequacy threshold is met. The model calculates the expected unserved energy by stochastic Monte Carlo simulation, having several weather years, intermittent renewable output profiles, outages, as well as intertie. It is important to note that resource adequacy is only one aspect of reliability, and that reliability includes other components as well, such as ramping capability, inertia, frequency stability, and short circuit levels. Next slide, please, Carmen. Moving to slide 50, the table shows the expected unserved energy for dispatch dominant scenario for 2030 and 2035 under base case as well as the three sensitivities. The long-term adequacy threshold values are mentioned in round brackets below the years respectively. This threshold value, which is as per ISO rule 202.6, states that around 1100 megawatt of unserved energy is acceptable by 2035. The EUE values with green color represents the RAM results that are well under the threshold. The ones with orange color represents the results which are the dispatch dominant scenario show no issues in 2030 and 2035. However, the results shows higher EUE in 2035 due to the additional resources not keeping pace with the increasing load. The first sensitivity is the addition of around 300 megawatt of demand response. It can be seen from the table that the addition of demand response has a positive effect on resource adequacy with a significant reduction in the values of EUE. The second sensitivity is the inclusion of demand management, that is, shifting of approximately 800 megawatt of peak demand from on-peak to off-peak hours. Demand management also has a positive effect on resource adequacy with a reduction in the values of EUE. The third sensitivity shows the impact on resource adequacy by the removal of around 900 megawatt of legacy unabated gas assets. The risk of unserved energy in this scenario increases significantly. The chart in the bottom shows the monthly as well as the hourly distribution of unserved energy under the dispatch dominant case. The bottom and the left axis shows values for monthly distribution, whereas the right and the top ones are for the hourly distribution. As seen in the chart, The most severe months are winter months of December and January, and the risk lies during the peak load hours between 6 to 8 p.m. Next slide, please. Moving to slide 51. Similarly, the table on this slide shows the expected unserved energy for the first mover advantage scenario. As seen in the table, the first mover advantage scenario shows increased EUE risk in 2030, generally due to the timing of the resource retirements and the new capacity coming online. There is some uncertainty to the assumptions made for the retirements of unabated thermal assets before 2030. And as such, these EUE values would be lower with the legacy assets remaining online beyond 2030. The results show much lower EUE in 2035 due to the sufficient additional resources coming online after 2030. As with the dispatch dominant scenario, the addition of demand response and demand management has a positive effect on resource adequacy with significant reduction in the values of EUE. Weighted gas greatly increases the risk of unserved energy. The monthly and the hourly distribution of EUE shows high risk of unserved energy in winter months and during the peak hours. Next slide, please. Moving to slide 52, likewise, the table on this slide shows the expected unserved energy for renewable and storage rush scenario. This scenario also shows increased risk of EUE in 2030. Clear in the first mover. Retirements of unabated gas assets before 2030. As with the previous effect on resource adequacy with significant reduction in the values of EUE. An additional sensitivity by removal of around 2100 megawatt of storage was performed for this scenario. The sensitivity shows the increased risk of EUE, thereby pointing the importance of storage on resource adequacy in this scenario. An interesting point to note here is that the removal of 900 megawatt of unabated gas in this scenario, the EUE values are much higher as compared to the previous two scenarios. This indicates high reliance of unabated gas, unabated legacy thermal assets for resource adequacy under renewable rush scenario. And as with the other scenarios, the risk of EUE is the highest in the winter months. However, the risk of EUE is shifted by around 4 hours in this scenario compared to the previous ones. The reason could be the storage supporting the grid during peak hours and being discharged by 10 p.m. Next slide, please. Moving to slide 53. As seen in the previous slides, the risk of EUE is very high if unabated legacy gas assets are retired under each of the three scenarios. This shows that the legacy unabated gas would play a very important role in transition to net zero. Each scenario has assumed the retirement dates for unabated thermal assets as well as addition of new different generation assets. However, the timing of these new assets is uncertain because of the complexities pertaining to the technology and infrastructure requirements to support them. Existing unabated gas assets have capability to support resource adequacy needs, and mandated uneconomic retirement of these assets negate the support these assets can provide to minimize the risk to resource adequacy. Next slide, please. Slide 54 summarizes the resource adequacy modeling just described. So it can be concluded that Alberta's market structure meets the resource adequacy in a net zero 2035 system in each of the three scenarios. Some of the risks observed in 2030 can be attributed to timing of new resources coming online and can be mitigated by the exit of legacy assets. Unabated legacy gas assets provide key support to minimize the risk of EOE and that its absence poses significant risk to resource adequacy. The risk of unserved energy for all the three scenarios are generally highest during the winter months and during on-peak hours. However, as mentioned earlier, resource adequacy is just one aspect of reliability. Additional work will be required to assess other reliability risks, such as ensuring sufficient ramping capability, system inertia, frequency response, and short circuit levels across the grid. The AESO will continue to monitor and evaluate the reliability impacts of electrification and decarbonization beyond 2035 on the electric system and respond proactively to ensure the stable and reliable operations of Alberta's grid. I'll hand over to Adam to continue with the cost estimates.
Thanks very much, Abbas. Looking at the scenario cost estimates, in the net zero analysis, we attempted to quantify the cost of each scenario to better understand the impact that net zero policy could have on the electricity system and the rates that consumers face. So to be explicit, the ISO included generation capital costs, incorporating the return on and return of capital. Those costs were annualized. We looked at the operating costs associated with the generation, and we looked at the transmission revenue requirements, looking at the return on and of capital and operating costs associated with the expected transmission assets in place at the time. However, we did not include the distribution system costs, and that's something that that we hope to dig deeper into in the future and learn more about working with the FOs. And we also didn't include all of the integration costs or additional support services that may be required in each of the scenarios. The ISO estimated the transmission system upgrades that would likely be required to facilitate each of our net zero scenarios. We used some optimization within the regions where we would expect to find various resources. And we used capital cost estimates and the transmission rate projection model that the ISO has used for various purposes to assess the revenue requirements associated with each of the transmission projects. The dominant incremental costs in all of our scenarios were related to generation, particularly generation capital, including return on and of capital. The generation operating costs also made up a significant component of the overall cost increases throughout the forecast period. And the transmission revenue requirements accounted for a much smaller portion of the overall system requirements to achieve net zero. On slide 57, we also looked at the levelized cost of electricity and the levelized avoided cost of electricity to understand the value provided by various assets. So what we did is we looked at the LACE, or levelized avoided cost of electricity, and subtracted the levelized cost of electricity. And we looked at different ranges that were resultant from our three scenarios and estimated the value by subtracting LCOE from LACE to understand what the incremental value was beyond the return on and of capital and the variable costs of the generation. So the LCOE included the capital. It also included capital return, included operating costs associated with generation assets, and the levelized avoided cost was an estimate of the value of the energy derived by generating assets. And it also included value for offsets produced for renewable energy or carbon sequestration activities. In our analysis, there's a wide range of LACE depicted by various generating assets, and that range is depicted in the thick gray bars shaded above most of the technologies. and the LCOA lies under the LACE in most cases, suggesting that most of these resources have the potential to make the required investment returns in the market. And so some of the key assumptions there were that there's a 10% return requirement for generating assets. For renewable assets, however, we looked at the low scenario incorporating only a 5% return, suggestive of favorable long-term contracts, reducing risk to those assets. Stepping on to slide 58, we'll look at some of the resultant total annual electricity system cost estimates. And these were used combining the annual generation capital and return costs for new assets, as well as the generation operating costs on an annual basis and the annual transmission system revenue requirements, including the incremental project, a specific capital that was associated with each scenario. And so the scenarios demonstrated that the net zero options were higher than the 2021 LTO reference case, probably not much of a surprise, but there was a fairly tight range of costs between the renewable and storage rush representing the highest cost net zero scenario and the first mover advantage representing the lower cost net zero scenario. All of them were within a fairly tight range that you can see on the bottom right graphic. Admittedly, these are not necessarily a perfect apples to apples cost analysis with the 2021 LTO because they did incorporate different levels of load and different technologies as well. Stepping on to slide 59, this provides a snapshot of the 2035 costs and illustrates that the net zero scenarios are fairly tight range bound, but the composition of costs did vary quite a bit between the net zero scenarios. And compared to the 2021 reference case, all three scenarios aggregated to much higher costs and were more expensive as a result. The expected cumulative cost increase to achieve net zero between those scenarios was between 44.1 to 52.1 billion before 2041, which, as Kevin had mentioned, is about a 30 to 36% increase compared to the LTO reference case over the time period that we reviewed. On page 60, or on slide 60, we reviewed the unit electricity costs as well. And so the unit costs were estimated by dividing the scenario costs by a range of the DTS load, representing the system load. Specifically, it was between 65 and 75% of AIL, as Leo had alluded to earlier. And by comparing the 2035 costs, we note that there's approximately a 40% increase in that year in the net zero scenarios compared to the 2021 LTO reference case. There are, of course, costs that we didn't include, and I'll just reiterate that distribution system upgrade costs were not included in this analysis, and incremental integration costs, such as additional ancillary services that might be required, were not incorporated into these cost estimates as well. The estimates did not include potential cost reductions also accrued to consumers that could come from other sectors. So, for example, electric vehicles would give consumers the opportunity to use electricity instead of gasoline, and those cost savings were not incorporated into this analysis. And so as such, as Kevin had mentioned previously, these don't represent an economy-wide analysis of the net zero impacts, but rather a more constrained focus on the electricity sector. And next, I will turn it back to Kevin.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. So I think what we'll do here is just do a quick discussion of next steps, and then we'll throw it back to Q&A, because I think there's a few questions out there, but people may want to ask questions about our next steps as well. So just kind of a recap of the key conclusions of our work. You know, there's multiple different ways that are conceivable to get to net zero by 2035. We've studied three scenarios, which in our view are the most likely to be achievable in that time frame, given considerations such as technology, regulatory approval timelines, et cetera. Nonetheless, we see that all of the potential pathways to net zero by 2035, while possible, are definitely challenged and have some risk associated with them in terms of meeting that goal by that time frame. Adam just walked you through the cost components. So relative to a non-net zero future, we do see that a net zero electric system would have increased costs for the components that we've looked at. From a reliability perspective, we do see that the market is capable of delivering sufficient supply, but the risks that we went through would definitely need to be considered and continue to be monitored. And there are other components of reliability that we still need to do more work to assess. From an emissions standpoint, we do see the need for some form of offsets to really get to the net zero goal that just pure physical emissions down to zero by 2035 would be really challenged to achieve. And then under demand, we do see the sort of the puts and takes of electrification against other things, and higher demand growth in our LTO reference case, but less than on average than what we've seen over the prior 20 years, but certainly with a shape that shows accelerating load growth when you get into the 2035 to 2040 period, and the impacts of electrification in a number of areas really take hold. You just go to the next step slide, number 63. Thanks, Carla. So what's the ISO doing next with this analysis? As mentioned, this is really expected to be the start of the conversation. Some of our next steps, really over the next kind of 12 to 18 months, depending on what you're talking about here. You know, I think most people on the call are very aware that the federal government is in the process of developing their clean electricity standard. The provincial level review of the TIER regulation has just kicked off. So the ISO is certainly, you know, monitoring the progress of those discussions and participating where it makes sense for us to do so. And we'll continue to do that and then assess how that, what emerges from that versus the assumptions that we've made in our analysis here, and may need to do further sensitivities to our work or develop new scenarios based on the details that emerge through those two policy discussions. The reliability impacts of these net zero supply mixes beyond just the supply adequacy is an area that we'll start more work on and developing what we're calling a reliability requirements roadmap, which would look at all the operational reliability implications of things like, you know, ramping requirements, inertia impacts, frequency response impacts, grid stability, and what the potential impacts might be and the mitigations that may be required to ensure that the grid maintains an acceptable level of reliability going forward. Leo touched on the recent release of our flexibility assessment where we looked at the 2021 LTO reference case and clean tech scenario. That work indicated at least some declining or concerning trends in terms of some aspects of reliability with the higher renewable supply mixes. So we'll want to take the supply mixes, especially with the higher renewables from these scenarios, and do a similar type assessment to understand sort of the magnitudes of the impacts and again the potential mitigation requirements for that. That work is expected to feed into some higher level kind of market evolution roadmap type discussions to identify any initiatives that may be required to support the sustainability and competitiveness of our energy-only market structure as we move through this transformation. look to ensure that we have the right price signals to incent all the aspects that we need for an effective functioning market and a reliable grid. We touched in the cost section about the fact that we have not included distribution side costs in our estimates. We do want to start engagement with the DFOs to better understand the potential impacts on their systems. Compare notes on our assumptions versus any that they might be making, so that we can understand that bigger part of the picture of the full net zero impacts, the interface between distribution and transmission systems, et cetera. So we would expect to be ramping up those discussions in the very near future. And then, of course, as we continue to go through time and learn more, we will be launching into our next long-term outlook cycle very soon. Our next long-term outlook will come out in 2023, next year. And so we do expect that we'll be incorporating additional net zero scenarios in there, information about net zero in that long-term outlook work. And of course, that feeds into our long-term planning process with the next long-term transmission plan coming out in 2024, which is based off of the long-term outlook supply and demand forecasts. So hopefully that gives a good sense of what the next steps coming out of this work are. So I think with that, Carla, maybe we'll go back to any Q&A.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kevin. So we've got a hand up. Jesse's had his hand up for a while. Jesse, if you just want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself before you ask your question. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much. Jesse Rowe with the Alberta Energy Efficiency Alliance. I've had my hand up for a while because I wanted to go back to the resource adequacy slide. So I put it up just after we finished that section. And I wanted to ask a couple of quick questions. The first one is around the definition of demand response and demand management that you have in there. So I note that demand management was talking about shifting demand from peak to off-peak hours, but there's demand response that can do that as well. And so maybe I'll just offer an observation. You can let me know whether I've got it right or some additional information on the definitions here that you're using here. But the first one that's listed, demand response, to me looks like a load shedding, whereas the second one looks like load shifting. Did I get that right, or is there more information you could provide on the difference between the two?
Thanks, Jeff, for the question. Yeah, that's correct. So demand response is load shed, like the price responsive loads, which would shed the load, and demand manages shifting the load from off peak to from on peak to off peak hours.
Perfect. Now, just good to get some definitions clear there. And then my next quick question was, I don't see any numbers listed for demand management in the 2030 column. Is there a reason that that wasn't included?
Well, we were straightforwardly concentrating more on the 2035 domain, so we did this analysis only for 2035. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't mean there's no potential for demand management in 2030. Just it wasn't looked at.
It wasn't just simulated for 2030. Just for 2035. Yeah.
Good to know. And then my last one is probably more of a comment, doesn't require a response at this point, but certainly in the work that we do, we look at demand management more broadly than just load shedding and load shifting. And so maybe that's a conversation we can take offline just in terms of other opportunities there might be on the reliability and affordability side.
Oh, sure. And just to come back to your previous question. So one of the reasons why we did not go with the 2030 was so that 800 megawatt of demand management, which we have considered, a major chunk of that 800 megawatt is coming from the shifting of profiles for EVs. And we see quite minimal EV penetration by 2030 and quite high by 2035. So the impact would really be not that material in 2030 as compared to 2035. That is the reason we just stick to 2035.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, some additional details on that is great. And again, we could probably take it offline. I think there are some shorter term opportunities on the demand management, load shifting side of things. But yeah, we can take that offline. I'll be reaching out to maybe schedule a follow-up conversation.
Oh, sure. Happy to. Thanks, Jesse.
Thanks.
Now move to some written questions, as we don't have any hands up. From Eli Simillion Consulting. Thanks, Eli. Could the ASO provide the hydrogen cost assumptions embedded in the chart in slide 31, if not already provided in the Power BI file?
I think I'd ask Adam to take that question.
Yeah, I don't believe we did include the hydrogen costs in the Power BI file, but someone correct me if I'm incorrect. But on slide 31, I think you can get an inference of what those costs might look like over time. There are a number of different assumptions that we've used to create that buildup, but we haven't released it as part of the data file, to my knowledge, or the Power BI file.
Thanks, Adam. All right, Roslyn McMahon. Do the numbers at the bottom of the chart on slide 56 incorporate potential NWS optimization, or is this based on wires build out only?
These were pretty high level transmission cost estimates, and they did not include specific non-wire solutions. The only optimization would have been location in terms of where we would have located some of the assets. So we didn't look at specifically non-wire solutions as part of this analysis.
Thanks, Adam. All right, the last question right now from Leonard. If it is not an apples-to-apples comparison, then why is one of your main conclusions that net zero is 35% more expensive than 2021 LTO?
Yeah, happy to take that question. Thank you, Leonard. So I think our philosophy or intention for comparing to the reference case was to compare the cost, whether you have a $50 per ton carbon policy or if you have a 0.37 benchmark in the electricity industry, compared to the $170 per ton scenarios that we look at in the net zero scenario. So from a consumer's perspective, the carbon policy definitely drives a different cost outcome. And so while you're right in saying that if we had priced in carbon costs at $170 a ton in the reference case, you'd see an increase in cost there. But our intention was to give some insight into from a consumer's perspective, when you look at those two different carbon policy outcomes, you see it gives a good perspective on the difference in cost that you can expect between those different outcomes. So I hope that answers your question, and happy to follow up later if you have any more.
I just wanted to add a little bit to that, Lars. Thanks for that answer. But I think at a higher level too, that the reason that we use that reference case as a comparator is that it is a non-net zero scenario. It's a non-net zero emissions profile. And so I think it does provide with different assumptions and granted, you know, there's impacts on load and supply mix, et cetera. But that allowed for that comparison of, with all these moving pieces, what is the broad brush stroke impacts?
Has raised his hand, so he might have a clarification for us. So, Leonard, if you just want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Leonard Alleen from Canadian Renewable Energy Association. So, first of all, I think this is a fantastic piece of work that that your team has done and put together. I think they're very the scenarios that you've done for the net zero analysis are very useful, especially from the context that you laid out at the beginning, that these are sort of scenarios and you're looking for signposts to see, are you sort of heading in one of these three directions or maybe in a direction that hasn't been anticipated? And I'm a big fan of that kind of analysis. I think it's very useful to give you sort of right, it's not a forecast in terms of like crystal ball seeing the future, but it gives you a sense of what the signposts are out there and what the future might look like. And that can be very useful for future discussions. My concern is that in this comparison to the 2021 reference case, many people, because of the, if you just read the executive summary or even your conclusion slide, and it seems to be that the takeaway is that, net zero, no matter how you get there, is billions of dollars more expensive than non-net zero. And I think that hides the fact that, your non-net zero case doesn't pay the externalities of the carbon cost. And in fact, if you actually include the cost, the forecasted cost of carbon in that net zero case, the cost is actually the same. And so you get a very different conversation if you say, look, the costs are all the same. Either you pay it in carbon or you pay it into the electricity system. That's a very different debate than, oh, we need to pursue net zero. That's 40% and $3 billion a year more expensive. So that's just my concern with the way that your results are presented and the lack of consistency in the carbon cost could be interpreted from people by running with your report. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, Leonard. I guess one of the risks of doing this work is different people view it through different lenses and interpret it in a lot of different ways. So your point's well taken. I would respond partly to that I think the carbon prices are also being set where they are because of essentially the general intention to move towards net zero. And so we're still looking at kind of comparative cases of one where there's less of a net zero goal and more where there is a net zero goal implied in the policy. But yeah, your point's well taken.
Thanks.
Take myself on mute. Thanks, Kevin and Leonard. We are going to move on to next question from Pembina. Could you reconcile the two statements to achieve net zero emissions by 2035? The application of offsets and credits is likely required, slide 46, and emissions performance credits generated by the electricity sector will decline in value until 2035, at which point they will no longer generate value, slide 29. Those statements seem contradictory to me.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Nick. And that allows me to sort of delineate between net zero economy wide and net zero in the electricity sector. And so our analysis focused on net zero by 2035 in the electricity sector. Specifically, we believe that there may be offsets and credits produced from various other activities that are not in the electricity sector. But to the first statement, to achieve net zero emissions by 2035, it is our expectation that there would be some amount of regulatory mechanisms, offsets or credits that would be required to get there, as physical abatement down to those levels is impractical given the technologies that we've reviewed and the assumptions that have gone into our report. So our expectation is that there are offsets and emissions performance credits that might be derived from other sectors that could be applied to the electricity space to mitigate those remaining tons of emissions.
Thanks, Adam. We'll go to the next question from Peter from Wolf Midstream. Slide 35 shows cogen as the largest generation supply with little decline from the 2021 LTO. Would you provide some more color as to why cogen would not decline as the HPV declines?
Thanks, Peter. The cogeneration forecast does show sustained operation of cogeneration facilities in our forecast, as well as some incremental new facilities. Our expectation for cogeneration aligns with some of the work that you may have seen from the Oil Sands Pathways Consortium. And our expectation is that they will pursue certain mitigation strategies, some of which might be physical strategies such as carbon capture or hydrogen co-firing or refiring, or perhaps renewable natural gas as a strategy as well to mitigate emissions. So we think there are a number of different strategies that can be used for existing cogeneration that would allow them to reduce their overall emissions while maintaining electricity supply to the system.
Thanks, Adam. We've got a question from Taylor from University of Alberta. Does your model look at strategies to combat wind discount and the duck curve as wind and solar energy is built into the system?
I can take that one, Carla. So thanks, Taylor. So a few different ways to look at that question. At the high level, the model is not necessarily looking at strategies to combat that duck curve. But what I would say is that in our modeling, you know, we do model the behavior of storage sort of on an hourly basis, and so would expect that it's responding to those market signals that are driven by that production shape. And so there is the expectation and the dynamics built into our model of the of basically an hourly market and that providing price signals for different types of resources to respond to that production shape. But this is also back to the, you know, the further work that we need to do to assess the reliability implications of these different supply mixes and their impacts on the hour to hour, the net demand variability aspect of the market and what the implications of that are and what further mitigations might be required there.
Thanks, Kevin. We're now going to move on. It looks like Jesse has his hand up. Jesse, if you just want to unmute yourself and go ahead and ask your question. Thanks.
Great. Thanks very much, Carla. Jesse Rowe, IEA again. I want to come back to the affordability topic. Certainly, it's a big conversation these days in the province, and I think by the numbers we're seeing here today, will continue to be an important conversation as we move towards net zero, and not just from an affordability perspective, but also a cost competitiveness perspective. In terms of attracting and retaining industry and residents in the province. And so I see on your next steps, I've got a lot of good topics to cover there, but I'm wondering where we can have a conversation about how to reduce costs of the transition and maintain or improve affordability as we move forward. Where's a good place for that conversation to occur?
Yeah, thanks, Jesse. And that's probably a bigger conversation than just the ISO for sure, because you get into a lot of concepts there of sort of affordability for different customer groups and strategies to deal with that. You know, I think we'd go back to the what we're looking at here is just a subset of costs in the electricity system and not a whole economy-wide assessment of the impacts to consumers of that. You know, there are certainly some, I think, general principle things that we think would help, you know, minimize the cost of this transition. Certainly, having regulatory certainty and stability is helpful. Wherever we can, looking to rely on competitive market forces and competition to drive innovation and efficiency. So, you know, I think those are kind of just general principles that will help minimize the cost of this transition. But, you know, some of the other things that are really more kind of government level policy, as to what levers they may or may not want to pull to change the relative cost impacts to different constituencies. And you know, one other thing I think in the transmission system cost work, the ISO's very, you know, we're aware of the cost considerations and concerns and are looking for everywhere we can to optimize the use of the existing grid and make sure that those price signals are there to ensure the optimization of the grid to try to minimize that additional investment.
I appreciate the answer. And certainly from our perspective, I mean, we see a big policy lever that's not on the table right now around demand side management. I mean, you talked about demand management and demand response a little bit in the presentation, but I do think the opportunities go beyond what's been kind of scoped within this analysis. And so it sounds like it continues to be at that government policy level that that conversation probably needs to be added and looked at, because I do think it is a real opportunity to take the edge off of some of the costs that we're talking about here. So, yeah, I appreciate your response.
Hey, you're welcome.
Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Jesse. Right. It's, we do not have any more questions or hands up at the moment. So Kevin, maybe we can move forward.
Yep, sounds good. Yeah, so once again, we really want to express our appreciation for everyone's attendance here today and the great questions and discussion. To help us improve these sessions, we do have some poll questions for folks. We'd really appreciate your responses. This is really, again, to help us ensure that these sessions are as valuable as possible going forward. And these are all sort of strictly confidential. So thanks very much for a quick read through the poll questions and responses.
Perfect. And we'll just give a couple seconds here to get those, allow people the opportunity to answer those. All right, Kevin, if you want to, I think that is the last slide. So, we have one more question from Paul. I shouldn't say one more question. We have a question from Paul. Paul, I am unmuting you if you want to unmute yourself on your end and introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you very much. It's Paul Lukanen with Customized Energy Solutions. Thank you very much for the presentation and the report. My question is a little bit more around how some of the results of the study may vary if the ASA were to include the deployment of hybrids, so solar plus storage, you know, on site specific or, you know, specific facilities that are built together as opposed to kind of standalone storage in the model, which I understand you are kind of running on an hourly basis. So I appreciate that. But, you know, the element of a hybrid makes that, you know, moves from a strictly intermittent resource to an element that has that controllability. And, you know, really provides the potential for a strategic operating strategy and, you know, essentially moving into the dispatchable realm there, which would make, you know, energy price hours more competitive, you know, in the long term. And I just wondered what the ASO's thoughts either as a next step or, you know, off the, in response to the question about how the role of hybrids or a certain level of deployment of hybrids might change the, you know, the total build out of renewables that you have in the model. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm happy to take that question. So thanks so much. Yes. So our approach for the net zero scenarios was to forecast so the renewables and the storage assets as separate assets. So we don't have hybrid assets in our modeling. It is something that we like to look to expand on in the future, as there's a lot of interest in the project list for hybrid assets. And your points are taken on some of the benefits that can provide. And I would reiterate that the way that we have set it up for the modeling that we have for the net zero scenarios, the storage is is still responding to the overall renewable generation in the market and transferring energy as part of that. And I think that's something to improve on or to look more into. Something we'd like to do is to study more of the asset level hybrid dynamics and how that impacts the storage and renewable build.
Thanks, Lars. Thanks, Paul. Right.
If there are no other questions, I think we could probably wrap it up. I want to just quickly thank Carla and the rest of the ISO team presenting, Adam with us, Leo, Chad, Lars. Thank you very much. And thank you all for attending today. We wanted to just also close by saying we're not seeking sort of formal feedback on the report in terms of a comment matrix or anything of that nature. But if you do have follow-up comments or questions, please do feel free to submit them to the ISO email address. I think it's forecast@iso.ca. We are always happy to hear sort of feedback or try to address questions to make this as valuable as possible for everybody. So thank you very much.
Thank you.